Good morning. I want to thank NIJ for funding our project and for asking me to be here today to talk about it, and thank all of you for coming and expressing your interest in this subject. Our project entails an assessment of five court-focused elder abuse initiatives. We called them that because they're all a little bit different. One is actually a court. The other four are connected to in or just very closely connected to and involved with courts, so we just had to make up our own term to describe them. And I will tell you more about them in a while. So first, just to give you an overview of what I'll do in my time today is talk about our goal, how we did our project, and then for some context, as well as to give you the measures that we use to assess the five projects, I'll talk about barriers to pursuit of legal remedies and guidelines for the state courts, and some of it will be what we've just heard Shelley talking about, too. I'll describe the five court-focused initiatives and our findings from them, and then just talk real quickly about next steps. So our goal, this is the long statement of the goal. Our goal was really to look at what these five projects are doing. Because there is no baseline data about any of them, we are not doing an evaluation, but we're really looking at their processes, their structure, to some extent their outcomes, and really trying to make some assessment of whether these are good projects that should be replicated in other communities and other states. Those of you who've been involved in the elder abuse field a lot know that because of the lack of research in the field, people come up with what they think are good ideas, and often are good ideas, but then everybody's like, oh, we have to go do this, and there's never any research to determine whether that's really a good idea and whether they're making a difference. So we were, to the extent that we were able to, trying to do that. My colleague, Pam Teaster, from the University of Kentucky, was our subcontractor and co-PI on this project. She's the researcher, I'm the lawyer, so we made a good team. We had a great multidisciplinary advisory committee, and Paige is actually one of the members of that advisory committee. We used the court-recommended guidelines that Shelley talked about and that I'll talk more about a bit, and some other guidelines that were created after our early project as the standards for assessing the five projects. And we've looked at an enormous amount of qualitative and less enormous amount of quantitative data for this project. For each of the five initiatives, we identified a key informant that was usually the founder or the manager of the program. We then did a very in-depth survey with those people to get background and a lot of it, more information than we had when we wrote the proposal about the project, how it was working, who was involved with it, and then used them to snowball and identify stakeholders in the five communities so that we would know who to interview when we went and made our five site visits. So we interviewed 92 stakeholders across those five site visits. We talked to the chief judge in each community. We talked to other judges who were involved with the project. We talked to court managers, court staff, court clerks, all kinds of court people. We talked to adult protective services. We talked to law enforcement if they were involved with the project. We talked to the prosecutors. We talked to public defenders. We talked to lawyers in private practice. We talked to all kinds of folks at all of those sites. We talked to three victims as well. We certainly had hoped to talk to more, but even managing to talk to those three was quite a challenge, unfortunately. We also reviewed court case files, and we reviewed 73 files across the five projects, and we were looking for a variety of things in doing that, and I'll talk more about that later. I can't tell jokes, but I like cartoons, so in starting to talk about barriers to going to court, I thought this one nicely illustrates, if you can't read it, it says it's bad enough being cheated out of my life savings, but what I really hate is having to get it back in small claims court. Older people don't like to go to court. They're very afraid of it, and younger people are too, but I think older people are more so. Now, back in the mid-90s, when we did the project that developed the court, the recommendations for state courts handling elder abuse cases. We did a research project. This was funded by the State Justice Institute, which is a quasi-governmental agency that provides research and technical assistance to the state courts. And we looked at experts all across the country, including prosecutors, to the extent that there were elder abuse prosecutors in the early 90s, civil lawyers, APS, and all kinds of other folks, judges and other folks, and asked them, are elder abuse cases going into court? If not, why not? And what can we do to help get those cases that should be in court into court? So lots of barriers to the pursuit of legal remedies were identified. Now, these are the system ones. I think we often talk about the more personal ones, and Shelley talked somewhat about the more personal ones, of just that fear of going to court, the embarrassment that, you know, your life savings were so small that you have to go to small claims court to get it back, but that's all that money that person had. The reluctance to get your abusers in trouble, particularly when they are your family members. The fear that intervention will result in you having a guardian appointed or in ending up in a nursing home. All those are the personal barriers about going to court or reporting to APS or some other authority. These, again, are the more systemic barriers about the pursuit of legal remedies. First, victims often just don't know what's available out there, and they don't understand what's available. So we often hear about victims who don't want their abuser prosecuted because they don't want him to go to jail, and they don't understand that judges have many other remedies besides jail that they might want, such as substance abuse or mental health treatment. The lack of legal services, and this particularly related to civil legal services, but the lack of a lawyer to help you try to get your money back if it's your money that's been taken, or to get a protection order to keep physical abuse from happening. Victim difficulty just getting to court, victim difficulty sitting in court. How many of you have ever been to court? So you know it's a zoo, right? A circus is often an apt description for it. And they have a cattle call, and, you know, lots and lots of people show up for hearings, and you have to get there at 8 or 8:30 in the morning, sort of like today. And then you can sit there for hours before your case is called. And if you are an old person who's frail, or you have a medication schedule that you have to keep on, or you have to eat at certain times of the day, that sort of environment can be extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, for you to do. I remember a case that I handled as a legal services lawyer at the beginning of my career where our client bailed, basically. We went to court, we sat there for a while, and he couldn't take it anymore, and he left, and he just didn't pursue his rights because of that. Victim fear of, ignorance of court proceedings. Like I said, older people just tend to really be terrified by this process. And I think particularly when we have people in minority cultures who, whether here in the United States or in countries, if they came here from other countries, had very different experiences with court system and with legal authority maybe than white people have had here, there may be enhanced reluctance and fear of the court system. Professionals' lack of knowledge, and that's what we heard Shelley talk about and what Paige is going to focus on, I think, in her comments. But certainly early in the 90s, I think this was a bigger problem than it is even now, of prosecutors not have training on elder abuse. Judges didn't have training. Lawyers certainly didn't have training. This isn't stuff you learned in law school. Back then, you don't learn it very much in law school, now 15, 18 years later. And where I'll probably focus my comments here is on the disparate impact of court practices. Courts like to think, and they say all the time, and we heard it during our experiences, that they treat everybody the same. And I think they really believe that they do. But the reality, whether they really do or not, the reality is that treating older people the same has a disparate, more onerous impact on them than on younger people for the reasons that I just talked about. If you are reliant on public transportation, and particularly on transportation for disabled people, to get to court, it may literally be impossible for you to get there at 8 or 8:30 for the cattle call. I talked about the difficulty of sitting there for hours. All those things then mean that court just doesn't work for you the same way it does for a person who has a car and the ability to sit on the hard benches in the courtroom for hours at a time. As a result of finding those things, as during our study in the early 90s, we developed a set of 29 recommendations for state courts handling cases involving elder abuse. These that are up here represent about half of those. I focused on pulling out the ones that were most relevant to what I was going to talk about today, and these sort of consolidate the 15. Clearly, and our first recommendations back then were that judges, court staff, and other professionals, including prosecutors, law enforcement, lawyers, and even APS, needed to have more training about elder abuse and how the court system, the judicial system, needed to respond to it. Expediting cases. So here in 2010, Shelley's coming up with some of the same recommendations that we came up with in the early to mid-90s. But of course, with older people who are more likely to die in the first place and maybe as a result of their abuse or exploitation or neglect, even more likely to die, expediting cases is an important issue for them. Accommodating persons with disabilities, some of the ways I've talked about already, were represented several of the recommendations. Providing emotional support and assistance, helping people get to court, explaining how it works, trying to make them less fearful to overcome that reluctance to pursue their legal remedies, to cooperate with law enforcement or prosecutors. Those were several of our recommendations. Referrals to community services. Very often, older people who have long-standing abuse problems or other problems, too, going on, end up in court and have never gone to any other social services program or anything else in the community for help. And it's the court that then ends up trying to refer them to appropriate helping agencies. Well, the courts need to know more about those agencies then in order to do that, and that was that recommendation. Enhancing intra-court communication and coordination. I remember very distinctly Judge Kirkendall, who was then a probate judge in Ann Arbor, Michigan, said, and probate judges, he handled guardianship cases. Most probate judges do, but not all. He said, I can be in probate court deciding whether to appoint son as guardian for mom, and I have no idea that down the hall in the criminal courtroom, son is being prosecuted for having abused, neglected, or exploited mom. And I'm going to talk about why that's still a problem 17 years later. We also recommended that the courts could provide leadership in the community about elder abuse, much as was being done and is still being done with domestic violence and with child abuse. We thought they could and should do the same thing with elder abuse. So that, again, those gives you the context of what the problems are, what recommendations we suggested to help solve those problems, and those were the standards that we then used, as I said, to assess the five projects. So let me tell you quickly about the five projects. One is an actual court. It's the Elder Protection Court in Alameda County, California, which is Oakland, right across from San Francisco. And it was started by a judge, Julie Conger, who was a criminal trial judge at the time, had been for a long time, and had been handling their domestic violence protection order docket as part of her role. And at about the same time that this got started, California expanded its protection order law so that it became easier for older people to get protection orders against their abusers. Sometimes protection order laws don't really include elder abuse situations very well. They may cover partner or spouse, but not cover if it's your kid or your grandkid who's beating you. So California broadened its law, which meant the court was starting to see more of these cases. So she, out of concern that they were seeing more of these cases, and because of the problems that I talked about earlier, decided to work with the court to create a special docket for elder abuse cases. And the way this works is that on Friday mornings, the Elder Protection Court is held. Friday's normally not a trial day in Alameda County. And court starts later than usual, so that deals with the problem there that I talked about. Many fewer people, it's much less of a cattle call than typical court. And it's a much calmer, quieter, softer, gentler process. We sat there and it was really very interesting how it worked and how respectful it was of older people and that they were a little slow. The prosecutor's office in Alameda County is very, very strong on elder abuse. He had a dedicated elder abuse unit before the court was started with several prosecutors. And interestingly, the public defender's office ended up playing a key role, which we did not expect to find in this situation. And I'll talk a little bit more about it later. The Elder Justice Centers are both in Florida, and that's about their only similarity there is their name and that they're both in Florida. One is in Hillsborough County, which is Tampa, actually where I used to practice. The other is in Palm Beach County, West Palm Beach. The Hillsborough County Project wanted to become an elder abuse court, and the Florida Supreme Court said no when that idea was developed, and that was sort of early on in the development of specialty courts, and they just didn't want to do that at that point. So instead, the Elder Justice Center there became a resource center, as well as provided victim advocacy services, and now is doing much more on guardianship monitoring as well. And I'll talk a little more about findings after I give the description of all of them. Palm Beach County sort of misled us about what they do, I think. It turns out that they help criminal defendants, and they help them by, actually, they help the court in recognizing whether older criminal defendants may have Alzheimer's or some other dementia or some other problem that really means that they are best suited to be dealt with outside of the criminal justice process. They had told us that some of those criminal defendants were elder abuse victims who maybe were now shoplifting because they had been exploited and needed to steal, for example, in order to live. I think in reality it turned out that they weren't helping elder abuse victims very much, and I'll talk again more about, you know, why not, where they're going, maybe how they're hoping to change that in the future. The Elder Protection Order projects are more similar as than the Elder Justice Centers are to each other. One is in Jefferson County, Kentucky, which is Louisville. The other is in Kings County, New York, which is Brooklyn. Interestingly, they both started at about the same time. Neither one of them knew about each other until we found out and started about them and started our project. What they do is help homebound older people who need a protection order apply for and obtain that protection order from the court without going to court. So they do it telephonically, and both of them have a process whereby law enforcement and a service provider, might be Adult Protective Services or somebody else, go out to the person's house and do the paperwork and then hook up with the court by telephone, and the judge hears the application, the petition for the protection order, makes a decision whether to grant it or not, and then if it is granted, the service providers and law enforcement help serve the defendant, the respondent, the person who now needs to stay away from the older person, and then helps protect them in that way. Okay, let me give you a sense of findings. I'm going to, for the most part, glom all of them together. And then I'll get a little more specific about each of them and focus on how they relate to prosecution. So what we sort of need to do here, though, is take out the West Palm, the Palm Beach Elder Justice Center, out of the picture. Because, as I said, it's really not helping victims very much. Okay? But for the most part, the other four projects did help enhance access to justice for elder abuse victims. The victims received emotional support. They received help in getting to court. They received accompaniment in court. They received referrals to other services as needed. They received often protection from law enforcement. They helped them get accommodations in court, so if it was necessary to have an interpreter or to try and schedule the hearing at a certain time because of a medication schedule or something, they helped in doing that. I told you they helped them get to court by arranging transportation, sometimes driving them themselves, I think, even though they probably shouldn't be doing that. In general, the four projects felt that more elder abuse cases were heard as a result of the project. Certainly with the protection order projects, those cases would never have gone to court in the first place because the victims simply could not get to court to obtain the paperwork to do the protection order and then to present their case to the judge. In the other cases in the Elder Protection Court, it's just an environment that's more conducive to older people getting to court, to feeling comfortable being there, and to the prosecution and the public defenders being involved with these cases. Everybody felt, even if more cases weren't coming to their specific project, that cases were heard more quickly, more efficiently. They were expedited on the calendar and just handled much more effectively as a result of the projects. They also felt that a sort of ripple effect, and there were many ripple effects of the projects, that the judges, and not just the judge who might be handling the specific cases, but the other judges in the courthouse too, were made more knowledgeable about and more sensitive to elder abuse as a result of the project being there. They felt that service providers learned more about elder abuse and about the court and about the court's role in because of these projects, that politicians were made more sensitive, the media was made more sensitive as a result too. All of the projects helped link older victims and to other services in the community, which was very important, as I talked about before. And again, enhanced public and professional awareness far beyond the immediate players in the court projects and initiatives, but beyond that as well. So let me focus a little bit, how am I on time? Okay. On prosecution a little more closely. The Elder Protection Court, as I said, in general, enhanced knowledge and sensitivity. Everybody felt, and again, it was the prosecutor's office, it was the public defender's office, it was the investigators who worked with the prosecutor's office and others, that having that sort of central focus for elder abuse in the court really enhanced everybody's game. It made them understand each other's roles better. It made them understand the approach and had a consistent approach because they were dealing with one judge rather than with multiple judges. And the judges had, even the prosecution and the public defender, both had some concerns about the judge and about being before one judge. And interestingly, Judge Conger had formerly been a public defender, so the prosecutor's office was a little worried that maybe she would be too lenient on abusers. And the public defender's office was a little concerned that maybe, again, just having one judge and having, you know, the prosecutor's office is usually always stronger, is better funded than the public defender's office. So they had that concern as well, but I think they all felt fairly comfortable with it. They all, by working together so closely, consistently, and often, developed trust in each other. They realized that they all had a shared goal of pursuing justice. And that was really important because it enabled everybody, as they put it, to sort of look outside the box and trying to come up with remedies that best help the older person, not just the system. The environment was conducive to elder abuse prosecution there. As I told you, the prosecutor's office had a longstanding multi-person unit on elder abuse prosecution. The public defender's office role was critical because they had to basically consolidate. Alameda's a big county with multiple courthouses. They had to consolidate all the elder abuse cases into the main prosecutor's office in Oakland, which basically put all the workload on one person who was already overextended. And so if the public defender's office had not been willing to play, this whole system never would have worked. The court would never have been able to take off, which was quite interesting. We did not expect that finding. In terms of the Elder Justice Center in Hillsborough County, where it relates to prosecution is by helping to prevent guardianship abuse. Their main focus now is on guardianship monitoring. That has come about due to budget cuts and because they think that that is what will make the program indispensable to the court and will keep it from being destroyed as a result of the current fiscal situation. So by doing that monitoring, they are preventing abuse and they are detecting abuse that's going on. Interestingly, law enforcement was not really involved in that project, and we did not interview anybody in law enforcement or the prosecutor's office there, but there's the tangential key from that project. I told you about the Elder Justice Center in Palm Beach, which is really much more focused on diverting older criminal defendants with dementia or other problems out of the justice system. So they're not helping victims directly, but maybe because they're doing that, they're making it easier for victims to report, to go to law enforcement. Back to what I said earlier about you don't want your abuser to go to jail, you want your abuser to get the treatment that he or she may need. That helps there. And the prosecutor felt more comfortable about these cases and the outcome of these cases because he knew that the Elder Justice Center folks would do some follow-up and some monitoring, and so they felt like this was the right system. The Elder Protection Projects, of course, help prevent further crimes by the abuser in this case, and because the violations of the protection orders are crimes, there may be more prosecutions of those cases as a result. And it also helps to develop evidence that can be used by the prosecutor in these cases. Intra-court coordination, I mentioned, was still a problem 17 years after Judge Kirkendall in Ann Arbor mentioned it. I had sort of hoped that with the advent of computers that these things would be less of a problem, but apparently they're not. It still is a problem. Courts still aren't communicating with each other. Now, a lot of judges will say, well, that's because we're not supposed to know what happens in other cases. We can't consider that in making our decisions. And that's valid to some extent, but I think to some extent it may also be an excuse. Judges were telling us that unified courts do help with that problem, but just having a court-focused initiative or having computers isn't helping with that problem. Providing leadership in the community is still an issue. In Alameda County, Judge Conger started, and the judge who has replaced her now that she has retired was continuing the Elder Access Committee, which the court sponsored quarterly, held at the court, brought everybody together to come just talk with each other, to share, to talk about issues, problems with the court, as well as problems systemically in the community and related to elder abuse. I think we still see judges very reluctant to take a leadership role on these issues. Some of that is for ethical reasons. Judges, of course, have to be careful about not taking sides. But I think also there, too, it's that can often be an excuse, that they just don't know about this issue still, they don't care about this issue still, and aren't willing to forge ahead in a leadership role, as has been done with domestic violence and child abuse. So those are things that hopefully will change. I'll wrap up. In terms of the court file data, I will just say that we found very little. What was in the court files was about as basic as it gets in terms of demographic information about the victim, maybe about the perpetrator. Often information about the perpetrator was in a probation record or in a sealed court file, a health or mental health file that the judges gave us authority to look at. But of course, what that means is that it's very difficult to do research and evaluation on these issues, and that has policy and funding implications, of course. And I'll wrap up just telling you we are in the process of wrapping up and writing our report. We'll do some articles as well. The project ends on December 31st, and we have information will be on our website once we can put stuff up on this project, and there's lots of other elder abuse information up on our webpage, too. Thank you.